From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the liberation of Libya, sovereignty in Greece, and human rights activists using new methods to communicate in China. The new leaders of Libya officially declared the country liberated this week. The head of the Transitional National Council, Mustafa Abdul Jalil, told thousands of people at a ceremony in the eastern city of Benghazi that it was time for Libyans to unite in the aftermath of the bloody civil war. The crowd often interrupted Jalil with exuberant chants, but behind the celebrations lie scenes of destruction. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro sent us this report from Benghazi.
This was the day so many here had been waiting for. A dictator dead, a new country born. In towns and cities and villages, there was fireworks and feasting that lasted into the early hours of the morning. The formal announcement of the end of 8 months of bitter fighting came in Benghazi, Libya's new leaders wanting the liberation ceremony to take place where the uprising began, on February 17th. In the capital, Tripoli, the central square was also packed. Amal Julaz was wearing a colorful headscarf and came with her young niece.
I feel very proud. Our revolution. 42 years, we don't feel freedom.
Mohammed Dargout Al-Jaidi felt a personal satisfaction.
I was in prison for 1 year and a half. I'm hoping that the future of Libya, it will be fantastic.
But that future is uncertain here. This is a country with no institutions, no political parties, and deep divisions in the aftermath of the fighting. The many challenges here were on display yesterday in Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. It's now a city of buried secrets. A group of fighters use a shovel to dig up a shallow grave. Two bodies wrapped in white sheets, stained with blood, are slowly uncovered. The men here are looking for their missing. There are hundreds, if not thousands, who are unaccounted for. The revolutionary forces suspect some of those may have been taken to Sirte, Gaddafi's bastion, and killed. Mohamed Margay is on the search team.
A lot of people missing. The rebels, we don't know how many. But we try to find the most people we can find. We know the attack very well, and after that, we make a search in the same position.
But instead of their dead, they uncover local residents who were hastily interred in this empty sandy lot in a residential street. Sirte was once a showpiece for Gaddafi, with wide boulevards and plush villas. No longer. So I'm standing in the number 2 neighborhood. This is where Gaddafi made his last stand, and it is completely decimated. It looks almost apocalyptic, as does most of the city here. There are still houses smoldering from being burned. Other houses have been looted, but most of the destruction seems to have happened during the fierce battles that took place here over many, many weeks. A woman sobs as she views the destruction in her house for the first time. It's a huge property with a view of the sea. It was shelled and smashed with bullets in the fighting. Like many buildings here, its charred walls look like they've been eaten by a creeping black rot. Her husband is waiting outside the building. He can't bear to go in. Al-Sharif Al-Zayani says 15 members of his family have been living in a tent outside the city. They were hoping to move back to Sirte today, but their home is uninhabitable. People think Gaddafi blessed this place, he says, but there's not a single factory here. There's no port, no source of income. We all had to leave to earn a living. Zayani says Sirte was a kind of dollhouse for Gaddafi, an homage to his vanity. Now we are really lost, he says. We are really confused. We don't know if the new government will help us, if they even care about us. Looking up at his destroyed home, Zayani says, we just don't know. No one has told us anything yet. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
Coming up, national sovereignty becomes an issue in Greece, and how microblogging is helping human rights campaigners in China. International financial markets rallied this week after Eurozone leaders agreed on a plan to deal with the European debt crisis. But although the government in Greece welcomed the agreement, many Greeks were sceptical that the deal could do much to help the country out of recession. As NPR's Silvia Pajoli reports from Athens, they're also concerned over the country's loss of sovereignty. There's disquiet about German interference in the destiny of Greece.
This is the office of the Nuncius stock brokerage firm. Unlike similar offices in New York or London, it's deathly quiet. So many people have been laid off that the offices are nearly empty, except for the president's. Alexandros Morataki sits behind a big desk, his cell phone ringing with calls from clients eager to know about the EU deal reached at dawn. His own profession is dying. In just 2 years, the stock market has lost 75% in volume, $110 billion. He doesn't like the EU deal. He says the EU, IMF and ECB, known as the Troika, have his country's fate in their hands.
Greece does not decide. Now the Troika people decides. They make experiments in the Greek market. Up to now, they were unsuccessful. Without growth, nothing will be done.
Moriatakis lists some other Troika results. Unemployment has doubled, and despite 2 years of draconian austerity measures, Greece is in recession and spiraling downwards. Many commentators echo this negative view. And there's widespread criticism that the Troika is going to have a permanent office in Athens. It will stay open until 2020. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has made clear that over-indebted Eurozone countries must be closely overseen by international inspectors. Many Greeks see this as the first step of a loss of national sovereignty. Newspaper publisher and journalist George Kirtsos says it's one thing to yield sovereignty in the name of a more united and integrated Europe.
And another thing, yielding sovereignty, because you have failed in your economic management, and now you have to face the reality of German domination. No government can sell this this to its people, to its own electorate.
Kirtsos points out that statements by German politicians disparaging the Greek people have revived old memories of the brutality of the German occupation during World War II. There have even been suggestions in the media that the German-driven austerity measures are part of a plan to reshape the Greek nation. But Kirtsos says this in no way resembles what the Americans offered with the Marshall Plan, which pumped lots of money into the Greek economy devastated by World War II.
So you can do nation building provided you pay the bill. But if you want to do nation building and force the Greeks to pay the price for the German nation building in Greece, this is something that cannot be done in political terms.
Anti-German sentiment is boiling. A slew of cartoons have depicted Greek government officials as Nazi collaborators. There are growing fears that Germans are plotting to buy Greek monuments and islands on the cheap. There's a revival of anger over Greek demands for compensation for Nazi atrocities. And a local EU office run by a German is referred to as the Gestapo. Even world-famous composer Mikis Theodorakis of Zorba the Greek fame joined the anti-German crusade in a call to a radio talk show.
They are pressing the knife deeper and deeper. They insult us more every day, driving us towards violence and to an explosion that could also be destructive for them.
But at a press conference today, Greek Finance Minister Evangelos Venizelos tried to reassure Greeks that their national sovereignty is intact. He justified the Troika's permanent presence in Athens, saying it's needed to avoid what he called communication problems. And he insisted that responsibility for and implementation of the EU bailout program lies with the Greek government alone. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Athens.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Some listeners, especially children, might find parts of our next story about human rights in China distressing. In China, Microblogs are transforming the way activists draw attention to human rights cases. Despite strict internet controls, activists on the net are using a Chinese version of the Twitter service as a powerful tool to plan action and educate others. NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Beijing.
The man in the video lies under a green quilt, apparently naked. His left eye and right ear are covered with bandages. The skin on his feet is discolored and peeling. Are you Yang Jinde? Asks a voice. I'm the lawyer appointed by your family. What would you like to say? His voice quavering, Yang Jinde describes his case. He was found culpable in a business dispute, and the court removed money from his bank account. He led a protest which turned violent outside the courthouse. He was then detained at a police dog training center in Henan. Yang says he was tortured to make him confess.
They put people in dog's cage, leaving only their heads outside, sticking out from the cage. Then they got police dogs to lick the heads. It's so scary, people wet their pants.
Yang says his feet were burnt with a cigarette lighter. He was tortured until he was paralyzed. He went blind in one eye after being slapped, and he was denied medical care. At trial, he was found guilty of leading a gang and given 21 years in prison. Zhu Mingyong is the lawyer who made this recording inside another detention centre. The lawyer shot the video out of desperation.
Yang's former lawyer tried reporting this situation to the courts and the relevant departments, but nothing happened. We released this publicly to raise attention from ordinary people and China's leaders.
Yang's sister also helped gain attention. On her microblog, she offered herself as a slave to anyone who could help her brother. She didn't want to talk to NPR, but propelled by her tweets, the video of her brother has gone viral. Even the state-run media have covered the case. Since the rise of the internet, blogs and Twitter, we the people have our own voice. Those are the words of Chen Guangcheng, a blind lawyer who's been held mostly incommunicado in his house since being released from prison last year. He had angered local authorities by exposing a campaign of forced abortions. But he's become the centre of a microblog campaign. A number of prominent intellectuals have released videos about Chen. This one describes his case as a most shameful page in history. Meanwhile, groups of internet users have staged visits to the blind lawyer in Dongshigu village in Linyi, Shandong province. His village is surrounded by plainclothes agents. Anyone who approaches is turned back, sometimes beaten or robbed. Mu Rong Xuecun is one of China's hottest young authors. Days ago, he made the trip with three friends. They were forcibly removed and driven off in a bus. When they tried to return, they were attacked.
One friend was kicked twice in the stomach. This very violent guy knocked me over on the ground. Each of us had small injuries, but they were very gentle to us compared to what happened to people who went before.
Such journeys are tweeted every step of the way. Mostly the tweets are deleted, but still it raises the profile of Chen Guangcheng. That's the calculation, especially when Mu Rong Xuecun, who has more than 1 million followers, is doing the tweeting.
I sent one tweet, which was retweeted 12,000 times before it was deleted. I guess that day at least a few million people knew what we were doing.
Mu Rong Xuecun has described himself as not being a troublemaker. He describes Chinese Twitter as a game changer, bringing about China's enlightenment.
These past few years on microblogs, I've seen lots of people discussing the idea that the nation is not the same as the government, and that human rights is more important than sovereign rights. So Twitter is driving China's enlightenment.
A couple of nights ago, netizens got close enough to set off fireworks outside Chen Guangcheng's house. They recorded it, of course, and put it online. This online pressure has had some results. Chen's 6-year-old daughter is reportedly being allowed to go to school for the first time. And, of course, the blind lawyer Chen and the tortured businessman Yang are becoming household names at home, as well as overseas. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.